You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. Well, as we come to the end of our first season with the Heart of Giving podcast, we thought we would do a retrospective of some of our guests and episodes on the question of what drove them to a career of service and giving and what types of causes in some cases they support. I hope you'll enjoy this walk down memory lane. Dr. Helene Gale, the CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, talks about her early days and upbringing and how that influenced her career and her desire to give back.
For all of us, where we come from and the things that we learned growing up really do help to shape our lives. And I feel like I was very fortunate to be born into a family that felt that giving back was a part of what we were put on this earth for. My parents stressed to all five of us that it was important for us to get a good education, but that we should also use that education in a way that could contribute to making the society a better place and create positive social change. Yeah, I also feel fortunate that I grew up in a time in the mid to late 60s when there was so much social change going on in our nation and around the world, whether it was the civil rights movement, women's liberation struggles in Africa, anti-war, all of these sorts of things, large movements where people were coming together to create positive change. And so for me, as a young adolescent and adolescent growing up during those times, it gave me the sense of wanting to be part of something bigger than myself. And I saw how people banding together could create really powerful social change. And so I think those two things, my family influence, the influence of the times that I lived, grew up in, you know, really did have a huge impact on me wanting to be able to be part of creating positive social change.
You know, as I think back to my own life, I can think of specific moments that sort of set me on this particular path, one of which was growing up in the YMCA movement and having great men around me who sort of shaped what I would become. As you think back, are there specific relationships or activities that you engaged in or moments that you can think back to that sort of shaped you in some way that maybe you didn't even understand at the time?
Well, when I think back, particularly during my high school days, I was very involved in both student government at large, but also with the Black Student Union at the time. And I think those two, being very involved in kind of student government and really, again, being around people who were trying to create in our own environment positive change. I also grew up in Buffalo around very nurturing and influential Black professionals. So I saw people who were lawyers and doctors and judges and councilmen for the local district and, you know, had that group of elders around me who believed in me and my friends and really wanted to make sure that we had that sense of what was possible and that we believed in ourselves and believed that we could accomplish great things. And so I think having that village, if you will, that helped to nurture me and give me a sense of what the possible was made a big difference for me as well.
Kevin Washington, the former CEO of the YMCA of USA, talks about his early life and upbringing in the Y and his long career of giving and service through primarily the YMCA.
I think I connected with you when I was about maybe 11 years old.
Yeah, but that sounds about right.
Yeah, but by that time, you had already been in the Y for many years. How did you get connected to the Y as a boy?
Yeah, you know, Artie, it's so interesting you tell a story because you and I both know the neighborhoods we grew up in. I was fortunate, as you were, to be at the Christian Street Y because of Bill Morton. Bill Morton was a youth director in South Philadelphia who cared about people like you and I, Artie. And he wanted to ensure that we got the kind of support that we needed to cross that ever tough bridge, if you will, from adolescence to adulthood. And Bill Morton, who's my mentor until he died, God rest his soul, just was a sweet, soulful young man who cared about Black kids. And he got me started in the Y, got me to understand what volunteering was about, helped me get my jump shot better, and created a path for me to get a scholarship to Temple University. And after that, he gave me my first job back at that Christian Street YMCA that we all in South Philly knew and understood how it affected our lives. So that's my story.
What about that why, though? Tell us about the Christian Street Y.
The Christian Street Y was we used to call it the littlest, biggest Y in the world, because everybody of color who was somebody in the city of Philadelphia was attached to that YMCA. We can talk about William S. Gray, and his father was attached to that Y. Judge King, Zach Taylor, all these names, Wilt Chamberlain, everybody who grew up in South Philly, and more importantly, leaders in the city, were part of that YMCA. Wilson Good came out of that YMCA as the first Black mayor of Philadelphia because of the Black political forum that used to meet at that YMCA. You know this name, Tick Coleman.
Yeah.
Who got so many young folks in South Philadelphia, who a Lincoln grad, he worked to get folks in college, help them get applications. He would be there every Monday and Wednesday nights, work with young people. Christian Street YMCA in that community was the leader in developing young talent to ensure that they met their full potential. And all of us revelate in Christian Street. And the other people, as you know, Artie, that did not get the kind of publicity, Kenneth Woods, who you'll know as Peanut.
Yep.
I thought Peanut worked there all the time. He was a fireman, but he volunteered there all the time.
That's Chief amazing.
Hunter, Ivan Wallace, all these folks who cared about young folks coming up, particularly young Black boys in that city. Christian Street was the place that was a part of us and still is a part of our heritage. So,
but you know what's so amazing, Kevin? I never paid a dime to go to the Y.
Isn't that the truth? None of us did. Well, first of all, Artie, we didn't have too many dimes at that place.
That's true. That's true.
But the reason why we didn't pay because Christian Street, because of so many of the leaders in the city who had lawyers and doctors and union leaders, raised money to ensure that you and I didn't have to pay a dime to go there. But they wanted to make sure that Y was there for us. So that volunteer engagement and that fundraising aspect that helped do it made sure that Y was there and possible to support many of us. I will never forget that experience. It stays with me, and it has shaped me in how I think about what organizations, not only like the Y, but other organizations can do to transform communities and young people to help them reach their potential.
Bennett Weiner, the Chief Operating Officer and Executive Vice President of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance, talks about what he learned from his mother and giving back and how that influences his work today. Go ahead and give our guests a little glimpse into who Bennett Weiner is.
Sure. I was thinking about that, and I think a lot of good things that we do later in life really start as a youth. And I think that's true with philanthropy as well. When I was growing up, as you know, Art, I lived in Manhattan with my family there and went to public school. And I remember my mother, I must have been maybe around 6 or 7, and she would collect donations for the American Heart Association. And back then, what that meant was, you'd have like a community person give her a special envelope, and she would literally go just in our apartment, door to door, knocking on doors, asking people to make a donation. And then she would take the collected funds and then would be forwarding on to someone else to forward to the Heart Association. And it sort of gave me the idea of, well, what's going on here? People seem to be happy doing this. And why is my mom going door to door? You know, as a young kid, you want to figure things out. But, you know, it sort of instilled in me the idea there's something more than just doing your daily chores. There's something about helping others that comes into that equation. And, you know, there are other charity experiences that I've had. I mean, the other one, especially in New York, a big thing when I was growing up was on Halloween. It was Trick or Treat for UNICEF. And we'd be given these little cardboard orange boxes. We go door to door, ask for candy, but we would say Trick or Treat for UNICEF. And the people would put coins in the boxes. And then we went to school to the next day. There were these immense barrels, and we would throw these boxes into these barrels. But when we did that, you'd see the volume of these boxes in these barrels was huge. And about how those dimes, nickels, and quarters in those boxes really added up to something big. And it wasn't just pocket change going to the charity. It was some hefty sum that was going to be collected. And so it was a message there that, you know, little things can add up to be something much larger than you are. The third story I'll mention is growing up, another thing around Labor Day, everyone would watch the Muscular Dystrophy Association Labor Day Telethon was a big thing. And of course, you know, Jerry Lewis had hosted that thing for a long time. And so I remember when I was a young teenager and a buddy of mine, I was in junior high, and a buddy of mine were, you know, got together and said, hey, let's see if we can get to, you know, to sit in the audience of the MDA telethon, because at that time they would film from New York. Years later, they went to Las Vegas. So, you know, we went into Manhattan and we were going to go line up to get into the show. But then the two of us felt, hey, you know, we don't want to go in empty handed. We want to bring some money in. So we had two, like, you know, beverage drink cups. They were on the street of New York as young teenagers asking for money for, you know, Muscular Dystrophy Association. And people would give us and throw us into the cup. And then when we thought we had enough, we went, got in line to get into the show. The way they structured it back then, they allow you to sit in the show for just 30 minutes because they had a lot of people that wanted to have a chance to sit in on the live part of it. So you go in, you sit for 30 minutes, and then you have to go out, then another group comes in. That's how they did it. So we got in the show, I mean, in terms of the audience, and the one thing, and in the middle of the audience, there was this plexiglass square, large collection area where it was just filled with dollars and coins, whatever. And I think once in a while, Jerry Lewis would go into the audience and collect money from them and then put it into this big box. And that became a shtick that he would do. So, of course, we were there. A lot of people in the audience were clamoring for him to come down and interact with the audience. So he would do that. And we were excited about that possibility because we had a bucket of coins also. And I remember him turning to the audience during one of the breaks and say, look, you know, I've been through the audience a number of times, but what's most important is the money goes to the organization, put it in the bin. And, you know, that's what we're really here for. And then he went back to the show when it got on again. So that's what we did. We put our money into the big bin. But I guess that was another message there, and that sometimes you get engaged in philanthropy because of a celebrity, because you want to interact. And, you know, we were young kids and that's what we wanted to do. But the real important message there, it's not the celebrity that really is important. It's the cause and it's the charity that you're trying to help. And sometimes people lose sight of that when they get engaged in philanthropy as well. And that was a valuable lesson that I think holds true. And the more I've learned about charities later on. So anyway, those three stories are sort of youthful lessons about philanthropy that taught me at a very early age some valuable concepts, I think, that are important even today.
Let's listen to Nancy Brown, the CEO of the American Heart Association. To be a relentless force means that we're unyielding in our commitment to fund critical research, to shape stronger health policies, and to implement programs that save lives. For a world means that we go beyond borders, both literally and symbolically, to ensure equitable access to quality care. Of longer, healthier lives means that we're creating a culture of health that enables people to enjoy more years and more years in their life. And of course, we know that heart disease is the number one killer worldwide. Stroke ranks second. And even when these conditions do not result in death, they cause disability and diminish quality of life.
With such a bold mission, you must need many collaborators in order to reach your objectives. Tell me about your work and your collaborations.
Absolutely. And just a little more context, Art, you know, the American Heart Association has more than 40 million volunteers and supporters in the United States and around the world. We have about 3,000 employees, about 120 local offices, and almost 40,000 medical and science volunteers that are part of the AHA. And with everything we do, collaboration is key. We collaborate with volunteers, with our donors, with our supporters, with other organizations, so that we can use the trusted brand of the American Heart Association and our science and our grassroots to truly make a difference. Some of the probably largest ways we collaborate include in our work in advocacy. We're very active locally at the state level and at the federal level in improving the health and well-being of people through active public policy change. It's a wonderful place where our collaborations come to life. In the area of science, we work with a number of other organizations to write treatment guidelines and scientific statements that really define the cardiovascular care and stroke care paradigms in this country. And of course, we work with companies and other organizations to help provide information and engage people in solutions to improve their own health and well-being. So everywhere we go, collaboration is key, and we've always considered it a fundamental part of how we will reach the organization's goals. Our mantra has always been, we cannot do this alone. Through partnerships, we will achieve so much more than anything we could do by ourselves.
Now my friend and former ambassador, Alfonso E. Lenhart, talks about his early days and upbringing and how that influenced his giving and service.
I really want to get into your career today and how it laid a foundation for a life of service and what lessons you will probably have for many people coming along today about the importance of service and giving. But let's start with your upbringing. You were raised in New York City, and how did your upbringing really shape the man you would become as a servant to society and to the world?
Well, that's a great question because like many people today, you know, you think of people in their lives who made a difference and who at key moments in their lives inspired them to do more. In my case, it was my mother. My mother was the rock of our family. She was the rock of our little community there in Harlem, New York. She was someone who inspired in me the idea that you could do more in life if you only had a purpose and kept in mind it's about helping other people. And so she was the person who inspired me. And quite frankly, although she's passed away, she continues to inspire me.
What were some of the lessons that you got specifically from your mom and activities that she maybe engaged you in that laid that foundation?
Well, Mom saw the sky as the limit. She had us involved in everything from Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, acolytes at the church. We were involved as altar boys. We were involved in all manner of activities. She ensured that my brothers and I and my sister always look to improve ourselves. No matter what it was that we undertook, Mom would always say, do the very best you could. And she always stressed that you always look for opportunities to give back. It was not all about you, but also how do you help humankind? And so Mom was that inspiration for us. And quite frankly, my two brothers and my sister have also passed on, but they in their lives were very successful in service. My one brother was a retired New York City policeman. Another was a retired New York City fireman. And my sister was an executive for a large telephone company. But it was always about service in ensuring that you could make a difference in the world and helping people in their lives.
Frances Wolfe, the First Lady of Pennsylvania, talks about why education is so important to their giving. So let me ask you about the causes that matter to you most and whether those causes have evolved over time. When I look at your career, I can certainly say your interests in your careers have varied, you know, throughout your life. Has that also had an effect on the causes that matter to you most, or have they remained relatively consistent?
I think sort of the subtext, as you would say, you know, running through everything, is the idea of the importance of education. When I graduated from college, SOAS, from London University, and I was not a stellar student. You know, I was, you know, I had a wonderful time at college. You know, it was a very good time. But one of the things, about a month or two after I graduated, my grandfather, who emigrated from Italy, wrote me a letter, and I still have it. And it's beautiful handwriting, you know, very ornate, you know, of a time when people were, you know, taught cursive in the grandest fashion. And, you know, he talked about me being at university, but he, you know, the first of his grandchildren, you know, to have gone to university, and, you know, what a good thing it was. But at the end, he said, by doing that, you know, this act of you graduating, you have brought honor to the family. And that was another thing that was instilled in us, that it was almost a job. It was a responsibility for all of us, you know, for my mother and her family. And she brought it to myself and to me and my siblings. You know, this is a job that you have to do, and you know, do it, you know, really well to the best of your ability. But this is, you know, serious work, and it is important work. And if I think of, you know, the things that we've been involved with in different ways, you know, that expression, you know, you don't want to teach someone to give someone something, but you want to teach them to fish. You want to teach them, you know, how to do something, because that kind of thinking has influenced the kinds of things that we've been involved with. But chief among them are educational institutions. You and I know that, you know, since we've both been on shared tenure on a college board, that it is transformative. It changes any person's life. And if we can get more people trained to think at a higher level, to perform at a higher level, and it's not always sort of academic scholar, but even in technical schools, to think in a mechanical way at a higher level, it affects all of the rest of us. It affects all of our lives and, you know, the rest of the community around each individual, for all of us. And so I, you know, those are the kinds of organizations and the causes that I get excited about and get excited about supporting.
Business mogul Andre Hughes talks about what drove his shift to philanthropy. I would really appreciate it if you would share with us how you came to, I guess, start something focused on social good after spending so much of your life helping corporations succeed. And we'd also like to get into how you actually rose to a career in business and where you started.
So, you know, I grew up in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago, in a place called Inglewood. I have two phenomenal parents. They're still with us. They were big on saving and working hard. And so I learned at least those two things from them. But some great people were in my life throughout high school and college at Purdue, where I studied engineering, that created some first opportunities for me that got me into corporate America, eventually over to a place called Arthur Andersen, which had a very small division, a consulting division called the Management Consulting Division. And I joined that group right after completing my master's in finance at the University of Chicago. And the reason we joined them was because they were looking for someone with telecommunication skills, and they were wanting to create a telecommunications practice. And so they were looking for some people that had, you know, steep experience. I had spent right out of Purdue about 4 years with AT&T, another year with MCI. I came over to be one of the leaders in their telecommunications business, eventually started a practice around network consulting that I founded that grew very quickly to a $1 billion practice. I was asked to become a global managing partner, one of the probably the youngest global managing partner at Accenture. And that's kind of what started it. Along that path, another 23, 24 years, I was in Africa, and I sat on our Accenture Foundation board. And there was this incredible opportunity that came to us, this organization called the African Medical Research Foundation, AMREF, wanted to train 20,000 nurses that were operating with a high school diploma, and they wanted to get these 20,000 nurses to the next level of nursing. And they had, Art, they had a 100-year plan to train these 20,000 people. Accenture found out about it, and we said, look, let's work with them in a philanthropic way to help them get there faster. And we proposed a program that would train these 20,000 nurses in 7 years, 93 years faster.
Wow.
I mean, those numbers are shocking. 93 years faster than their plan. And it was through that experience, Art, that I'm now in Africa overseeing how this program is coming along. The first 89 nurses are about to graduate. I'm speaking at the graduation as one of the keynote speakers. And, you know, it was a heart-fulfilling kind of thing. And right after that, I'm out greeting the family members. And I ask the leaders, I'm there for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, and I ask the leaders previously to take me to the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there was this one place, Art, called Kibera. And it's well known. It's probably the largest slum in the world, or the second largest. Nobody's competing to be the worst, right? And they just refused to take me there. But for some reason, the way I interacted with these families after this graduation, they were touched to say, okay, we're going to take you. And they said, do you want to go back to the hotel and change? And I said, no, let's go just like this. And I didn't want them to change their mind. And so we're off to Kibera, and we're walking through there. And Art, I tell you, if your listeners haven't Googled Kibera in Kenya, right outside of Nairobi, I highly recommend you do it. It is one of the most amazing slums I've ever been in. I use the word amazing, wow, because there's nothing about it,
wow,
that you would ever contemplate. I mean, everything is radical. I mean, it is so, and I hate to use words that could offend people, but it is just not a good place. And, you know, if I had to think of something that would be analogous to it, it wouldn't be a kind word. It wouldn't be a kind place. If you could think of the worst place you wanted to live eternity, that's what this looked like without me saying the word. And so I'm walking through this place and I'm happy to describe more, but I'm trying to get to the answer to your question. We can kind of go back and touch on any of this history that you want. And God touches my heart. I mean, melts my heart for these people. And I could hear him speaking to me and saying, you know, it's time for you to come work for me. And he dropped in my spirit a vision for uniting the resources necessary to lift up a fallen people.
Wow.
Those were the words that I heard. The precise words that I heard were those words. And ever since then, when I got back to the U.S., I told my friends about this experience. Later, God revealed this name, Powered by Action. We had picked several other names for what we would call this, and they just didn't work. And one day I'm walking down Michigan Avenue in Chicago, and Powered by Action comes to me. And we launched Powered by Action, a 501c3 nonprofit organization focused on building technology, building software innovations that would change the service delivery and program delivery paradigm for nonprofits all around the world. And so my wife and I have been pouring our personal resources. We've not asked anybody for money. This is very risky, as you would imagine, to build a technology platform like this. It had never been done before until now. And in the last couple of years, we've been working with nonprofits to introduce them to the platform, to onboard them, their staffs, their constituents or people that they serve, and working with them to deliver their services digitally and virtually. And who would have thought that 10 years ago, God would have given us this vision, and then 1 year ago, COVID hit the world. And as I was mentioning to you earlier, everything has just been exponential growth in the last 12 months. And so that's the quick story, Art. We could talk about any facet of that you want, but that's the cliff note.
Meski Brahani, who has spent her career in service to those in underdeveloped countries, talks about what motivated her to do that. What were you doing that led you to a career with the World Bank these last 10 years? And particularly, what was it that really got you interested in international work?
Let's see. I would like to start maybe from where I got my initial ideas behind an international career. I'd say my dad was an agronomist, and he worked on breeding different kinds of crops, especially corn and sorghum, and trying to find ways for producing food that improves the quality of life for people around the world. So I saw him really working in, you know, many different countries and trying to improve people's livelihoods. And that was something that always inspired me. So I was very interested in doing international work, but I really wasn't the type to work on agriculture or the sciences, really. I was fascinated by people. And so when I went to graduate school to get my PhD, it was at the University of Chicago, I had an opportunity to study international development. It was in political science, but I was very much interested in how society, people, communities can affect the ways in which their states are built and the ways that the states are governed. So I did field work in Mauritania for my PhD. I spent about a year and a half working in an informal settlement in the capital of Nouakchott. And I saw at the time that there were people migrating from the rural areas because their sources of livelihood, many of them were pastoralists, had, you know, basically disappeared. And they were settling in informal settlements all across the city and living in conditions that were, you know, didn't have any running water, didn't have proper housing, didn't have access to, education. They were very far away from their sources of employment. But at the same time, these communities had a way of cooperating, helping each other, and bringing about change. And I also saw how in this context that if the government really was able to support them, they can really catalyze the energies and the knowledge and the skills that people have regardless of their income or their education level. So that was really what got me when I was, you know, spent a year and a half there listening to people, observing how much they suffered, that I could perhaps work on urban development issues and try to bring about change at a global scale from, you know, that experience.
It's been an exciting season. I hope you'll stay with us for season two. We have a great lineup of guests planned and topics that I know you'll be interested in. And I want to thank all of our listeners and subscribers and donors to the Heart of Giving podcast. We'd also appreciate it if you would give us a positive review, especially on Apple Podcasts, because this will help us build audience. If you want to do a little bit more, you can become a sustaining donor to the Heart of Giving podcast on patreon.com. That's patreon.com. And also, finally, if you want to reach us, because we'd love to hear from you, please do so on Facebook, or you can just send us an email to heartofgivingpod@gmail.com. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.